or in the more prominent and fashionable colors of the decor of their homes and things of that nature. Thus, color consciousness may very largely explain the importance of the precious stone in the life of the person. It is an intimate color association. It is also a status symbol. The individual possessing a rare and valuable object is undoubtedly psychologically influenced by this fact alone. This object bestows a certain sense of superiority, of possession upon the owner. It causes this owner to have a certain internal increase in the sense of self-importance, which can psychologically have an effect upon his life or character. Thus, the explanations are numerous, but the true explanation perhaps will not be known for a long time. We also realize that various minerals and stones have very definite properties which differ, so that some, like the lodestone, are known to possess magnetic factors. Others are not so well recognized in this. But the tithonite, for example, is a stone which of itself and naturally is luminous in the dark. This type of situation indicates a different kind of chemical construction. And this type of difference has been of interest to peoples for a very long time. We know also that in the early development of peoples, certain types of stones, particularly the nearly complete transparencies, such as crystal or the diamond, have had a peculiar and wonderful fascination. We do not know at what remote time the crystal became involved in divination, but it was certainly a long time ago. And as an object of divination, it has influenced history for thousands of years. And this habit of the use of the crystals in divination is very widespread. It is almost universal. So we can say to ourselves, what does this mean? Is this something that has brought certain stones into particular prominence in the respect and admiration of mankind? How has this affected the reaction of man to the entire mystery of gems? Old times apparently made use of certain preparations by which a stone was supposed to gain the power of mirroring or reflecting episodes and incidents occurring in the world. In the Central and South American area, it was customary to carve magic mirrors or magic glasses out of obsidian. Now, obsidian was this mysterious black material like volcanic glass, which was used in the making of the razor blades. A disc of obsidian would therefore be apparently a disc of jet or black. This jet or black disc was said to be used by the magician for the conjuring up of shadows or mysteries within the depth of the stone itself. It is recorded, for example, that at the time of the occupation of Peru by the Spaniards under Pizarro, that these native diviners, the magicians, looked in their obsidian mirrors to see whether or not the Spaniards would accept the ransom for their king. And when they realized that the Spaniards would take the ransom and still destroy the king, which was their intention, the Incas refused to reveal their treasures. The king died, but the treasures were never found, because the instructions shown in the obsidian mirrors indicated that it would be no use to try to pay off the Spaniards. You would never be able to do so. The Indians were quite correct in their estimation of the circumstance, whether they made use of magic mirrors or not. the Druids and other peoples used crystals of various kinds to focus the rays of the sun to light their altar fires at the sacred festivals of the year. Crystals cut into lens shape were used at an early time by the Romans as magnifying glasses and as a substitute for spectacles. The crystal was set vertically or on edge in a finger ring, and the person using it simply held up his hand and looked through the side of the stone. Some of the emperors were said to have had these so perfectly prepared that they were able to look through them and see the action of armies in the field several miles away. This type of glass is found in many locations as an aid to vision. In fact, so was used in China also at a comparatively old time. The clear or clouded crystal balls or crystal discs used in divination have also been subject to a lot of thought. Some of the earliest ones have a smoky look. They are not really clear. And this smoky look appears like clouds in a troubled sky. And observers, students of the problem, have come to the conclusion that under psychic stress, these natural patterns in the crystal, these clouds and irregularities and tones and masses and shapes, could very likely be caused to appear to take specialized forms. Or the diviner could see in these masses a likeness to a certain shape, much as in the reading of tea leaves, or perhaps more psychologically in the distinguishing of the images by the Rorschach test, in which ink blots become symbolic according to the interpretive power of the person looking at them. So if these various shapes were naturally in the crystal, in the cloudy crystal, which many times they were, then it would be quite possible to assume that they formed catalyzing agents, points of focus or attention, and that the images seen in the glass actually were projected upon the glass by the person looking at it. That these shadows and shapes and visions were actually in the mind of the person, and that they were projected as visual phenomena into the glass. This would only mean one thing, that instead of having a magical lens which could foresee the future, you transfer this power of foresight to the person, assuming that the person might be in a better condition to have some extension of faculty or power than with the crystal. And that the vision seen in the crystal represent the psychic sensitivity of the person using it. There is much to support this in another way, because psychic sensitivity has nearly always been accompanied ultimately by some kind of psychic disaster. The psychic being unable to control his own procedures has gotten into trouble in nearly every instance. And this has been mirrored in his glass by the gradual changing of the forms and shapes which he sees, which from being in the beginning benevolent and friendly, very often end up as evil and monstrous shadows, fearful and terrible in their implications. This type of psychic sensitivity occurring in persons without such assistance would indicate that the transformation is due to psychic change within the consciousness of the individual. I mentioned last week a very famous example of this crystal situation in the shoe stone of Dr. John Dee. The shoe stone, in the sense of the Old English, meaning to show or reveal, the revealing stone, was a small sphere of crystal-like material, which Dr. Dee used on numerous occasions to enlighten and inform Queen Elizabeth of England, Elizabeth the Great, of the impending changes of her fortunes. It is said also that it was by means of this stone that John Dee accurately foresaw the famous gunpowder plot, which with the attempt of Guy Fawkes to blow up the House of Parliament. he saw the thing or this incident occur in his shoe stone and reported it to the court, which immediately searched the properties and found the barrels of gunpowder in the basement of the House of Parliament. This caused, of course, Dr. D, as he himself tells us, to have every kind of preferment heaped upon him except any financial help when he needed it. This was not at all appearing. The country was grateful up to the extent of no financial cooperation. But this shoe stone, which is now in the British Museum, is a typical example, in all probabilities, of a focusing instrument for calling into focus the energies of the individual. In other words, these magic stones were sort of hypnotic agents. They reduced the individual into a kind of trance-like condition by means of which his own subjective life came to the surface, as in the problem of dreams. Therefore, the vision in the glass is similar to the vision in the dream. It is a pressure through from the subconscious, based either upon fact or upon some internal conviction about fact. It is perfectly possible for an individual to believe very firmly something that does not prove to be true. Under such condition, his believing may cause this image to be projected, but the event does not transpire. In order to understand the legitimate explanation of the event, such as Dr. John D. and the Guy Fawkes plot, it is necessary to assume that there is a communication, an extrasensory band, by means of which, under certain conditions, the individual can tune in events which are to come or which are occurring around him. Then the glass simply becomes the catalyzing agent, which throws him into a negative condition in which these images begin to move out from his own subconscious and are therefore apparently seen in the glass before him. Magical glasses of this nature are reported everywhere. And we know that Cagliostro, the famous French magician, made use of these continuously in the development of his various esoteric arts and purposes, and also in healing, that it was possible to diagnose disease by means of these lenses or these glasses. Where color also had importance, and in more recent times, legends relating to stones were used to tie them to the various months of the year so that they had some special or distinct meaning. So gathering these tables together, I made a little list which I thought was perhaps interesting and might be a little bit helpful. This does not represent, by any sense of the word, a unanimous accord. But we felt that if out of, say, 18 tables, 12 or 14 agreed on a certain stone, that was the one we would use for our discussion anyway. And you can always get books in the libraries and things of that nature going further into this problem if you're interested. But why were some of these stones taken? In some instances, certainly for color, and in other instances, certainly for ancient meanings that might go back into the old religious mysteries and into the early beliefs of the Christian Church. There's no doubt that stones became practically a method of distinguishing the orders and hierarchies, both of the church and of the universe itself, so that there were stones for the orders of angels and archangels, stones for the Trinity, stones for the fallen angels, and all kinds of stones for that very low degree of fallen angel, which we now call humanity, which is somewhere at the bottom of the heap. In the old times, at least, the dominant stone given for January, this doesn't follow exactly the astrological pattern. It was really their month stones, principally, in the old system. Of course, you can go more into detail and tie them directly with the signs if you want to, but most of the old books simply refer to them by the month over which they rule. The January stone was given by most authorities to be the garnet. And the garnet might very well have to do with that. In the first place, January represents the beginning of something. It is a new thing. And wherever you have something new, you generally had related to it a stone of considerable color, of depth, and of strong hue. And the fact that the sun increases in light after the winter solstice would probably associate it with a stone like the garnet. Your positive stones, your active stones, are the ones that run through the reds and the violets and the orange shades. Your passive stones are the greens, the blues, and the violets, particularly the lilacs and blue violets. So that the fact that the garnet was assigned to January would indicate, perhaps, as the ancients believed, that it was a stone that bestowed life. Now, in therapy in the Middle Ages, garnet was used as a medicine against poor blood. If the blood was deficient, and in those days no transfusions were possible, if the blood was deficient, it was believed that the garnet increased blood or brought back life, therefore would be associated naturally with the beginning of the year. The stone of February was assigned as the amethyst. And the amethyst has very long been a stone associated with religion. It is a very important stone in the Roman Church, particularly recognized as the symbol of the bishop or of some higher member of the clergy. The amethyst also was regarded by the ancients as a stone of friendship, of fellowship, of fraternity, and perhaps has been closely associated with the commandment of Jesus to love one another. Therefore, the amethyst was a stone of service, a stone of dedication, and a stone of self-renunciation for common good. In more aggressive and positive forms, it was used as a means of bestowing dedication. Not so much courage as this peculiar devotion to principles or ideas. It was a stone also associated with self-sacrifice. So that the amethyst was an idealistic stone, a stone of man's faith in the substance of things hoped for, and his willingness to sacrifice and struggle for the attainment of intangible good, good beyond the ordinary course of things. March was a difficult one because the testimonies were almost completely divided. There was a slight edge in favor of jasper, but bloodstone ran a close second. And to most people in this country, I believe, the bloodstone is the more common association of the two. The jasper is found more in Europe and in South Asia. But in any event, the bloodstone or the jasper seem to be associated with the idea of sacrifice or martyrdom. And therefore, the bloodstone probably in Europe gained belief because this month was, for many peoples, associated with the Easter season, especially in view of the older calendar systems. This was a symbol, therefore, of sacrifice. Jasper was a weapon symbol. It was a symbol of offensive protection. The bloodstone and the jasper, therefore, could both be defined as defenders of the faith. And the bloodstone particularly represented the defender, the one who was ready to die for the cause, for the belief, or would not under any condition sacrifice or compromise principles. It was the symbol of defense, of faithful stewardship, of continuing loyalty and abidance. April was again one that was a little difficult to nail down to one stone. But out of the general picture, the diamond came out as being the most dominant, which would again not be unreasonable as April was the symbol of the vernal equinox and the annual birth of the sun. The sun, according to Paracelsus, had an affinity for the diamond, and the diamond was therefore the sun of the gem kingdom. It was the center around which all the other jewels, so to say, moved in their orbits. A number of interesting legends about diamonds have come down to us, not only such curses as the Hope Diamond and the various ill fortunes that have followed so many of these great stones, but some of a more pleasant and amiable type. One of the interesting ones is that it was reported for nearly 500 years in Europe that if you put two diamonds in a little box and left them alone for 3 years and opened it, there'd be a third mysterious little diamond present. Now, this was, of course, a very difficult thing to experiment on, because it was first of all necessary to make sure that you had a properly balanced parents for this new diamond. You had to make sure that you had a mother and father diamond to work with in the first place. Your chances of being certain on this were difficult, but it was actually believed, and there are written reports of apparently the highest validity, that diamonds, either in the ground or in other places, will increase if left alone for a long period of time. Also, several gem cutters have stated that diamonds will increase in size if completely left alone over a long period of years. Now, this has been another question. Do gems grow? There is some evidence to indicate that they do, that they do increase. In fact, they must have at some time passed through some form of growth, or they wouldn't be here. And the fact that they are widely scattered indicates that they had to have been precipitated in some way. And this precipitation may be a continuing process. The older lapidaries were quite certain that precious stones are still being made in the earth. And, of course, your medieval philosopher had a whole group of little gnomes and something of that nature to do the hard work. We don't consider that, but many specialists have insisted that stones do grow, therefore that they are alive, and that it is quite a mistake to assume that they are merely inanimate, because they live in a level of energy consciousness different from our own. The diamond, by the way, was among most people the symbol of leadership, of preferment, of precedent. It was the symbol of honor, of truth, and of purity. Somehow, along the way, though, used to get into some rather impure relationships with mankind. It was also always held, and magically true, that a stone, the qualities of which were perverted by the owner, would turn upon and injure that owner. That if you had a certain stone, you must live up to it. If you do not live up to it, it will become an avenging force against you, on the assumption that its own energy never ceases. And therefore, if you go contrary to that energy, this energy sets up conflict within yourself. So the ancients advised persons who were not honorable not to wear these stones, because they would only disgrace the stone and hasten the fall of their own dishonorable projects. The diamond especially was therefore a symbol of purity, of integrity, of leadership, of honor, and of all things that were right and good. Now, May also had its stones, and they were quite numerous. And again, it was difficult out of the old pattern of things to select the ones, the one that seemed to be the most outstanding. The most common one, when we got all through with it, was the agate. The agate seems to be rather consistently the stone of this month. It will note, of course, that the stones vary in rarity considerably. Apparently, there is no consistent list in which all of the months are represented by gems of top value. There are nearly always rare and less rare stones. The ancients said also that these represented the rare and the less rare virtues of mankind. There are some abilities, powers, and energies which are rarely distributed among men. There are others that are more commonly available, and therefore that these differences would naturally and properly be associated with the stones representing these energy fields. Now, the agate being associated with the month of May would seem to be quite reasonable and proper. This is a transitional month. It is a month going in toward the spring, toward summer and the planting and the various works and labors of men. And in the ancient times, the agate became the symbol of industry. It became the symbol of lands and of properties, of stewardship and proprietorship, of trade and commerce and exchange, and bestowed upon the individual honesty in weights and measures, integrity in relationships, and a strong merchandising instinct. This stone, therefore, was associated with practical success. And like success itself, it was stratified in many ways. For many persons feel success in different patterns or arrangements. So the person who fulfills his own purpose succeeds. And in the story of the agate, you have much emphasis upon the person doing the things that he feels he is able to do, that he wants to do, and to find his satisfaction, his joy, and his fulfillment in adjustments, in happy relationships with chosen fields of activity. That the person is truly happy who enjoys a good but moderate way of life. The agate was therefore peace through moderation, through intelligence, through discernment, through acceptances rather than through demands. And as the sign involved in this month are rather demanding in the astrological setup, it seems that this is especially a practical fragment of advice to be patient and pleased with the gentle things of life. Now, the month of June, most of the writers decided was the emerald. And the emerald was a stone associated with the increase of the vitality of nature. The emerald was a stone that had to do with the whole earth. The earth with its marvelous greenery and its wonderful clothing of verdure, flowers and plants. The emerald became the symbol, therefore, of the beauty of nature, of all natural things and natural processes. And out of this concept of natural processes came one, of course, which all ancient peoples particularly recognized and admired, and that was the symbol of the home, the symbol of the family, the symbol of the procreation in nature, the symbol of perpetuation and amity, and of personal affection between individuals. So the emerald came to be a symbol of fertility, of affection, of regard, of graciousness, of nature, and of simple natural ways of doing things, of love of art and nature, and the fulfillment of the normal requirements of the rhythm of nature, which would be, of course, generation and harvesting, and the storing up of supplies against the winter, and all of these natural processes. And through extension, the emerald was a symbol of natural law within which all things must exist and by which they survive. So it's a surviving symbol, a glorifying of natural, normal, beautiful things, and a life made happy by harmony and adjustment and fruitfulness and the sense of the rewards which are natural in good deeds graciously performed. The month of July we had a little trouble with because they couldn't really make up their minds, so we'll have to tell you what their general conclusions were. I think perhaps the onyx won by just a shade, just a tiny bit. But very close to it and almost equal was the turquoise. So I would say that the two could share this distinction. I believe that the onyx represented more or less the use of decoration or support or substance. Very often in ancient art, the onyx was used very generously to represent royalty, distinction, and various honors. It had to do with pushing forward into things, to achieving things. It was a sign of temporal leadership. It was a sign of authority, the sign of the statesman, the governor, the leader, either appointed or elected. And it was frequently used in connection with the ornamentations of objects of public office, such as seals and symbols of states and nations. It was also frequently a pedestal or base upon which something stood. All different types of this material, from rare to comparatively common, occur in symbolism. But I think that the general theme or theory behind it is that it is the symbol of responsibility, that the individual must accept the problems of leadership and must equip himself to carry responsibility with dignity for all things that come to us, whether it's a beautiful jewel or a job. Both present responsibilities which have to be met, and the individual who is not willing to care for that which he receives is unworthy to possess or to have or to enjoy. The turquoise is a sky symbol and was used among ancient peoples as a veil, the blue veil or the sky ocean symbol that divided our world from the world of the divinities. Therefore, turquoise was a sign of the superiority of divine powers, again, of authority, the leadership of the tribe, of honor and distinction, of valor and achievement. But in every case, it represented the wisdom of experience, of justice, and of judgment. Therefore, to wear it indicated that you were a responsible person, having assumed and carried the duties of your people. August was associated largely with the carnelian. There seemed to be no great division of opinion in connection with this. This stone has to do with the future. It was an ancient symbol of good things to come. It was a talisman for future good, to build now for the better day, far-sightedness, looking into tomorrow with hope and sagacity. It was also associated with patience, for all things that are important must be achieved patiently and without unreasonable haste or pressure of time. We might extend this, therefore, to mean a symbol of orientation and integration. The individual who has set his own life firmly upon a reasonable basis, that in full faith, acceptance, and understanding, he is building for the kind of future which he plans, and therefore that he has become a director of his own destiny, self-directed, self-responsibility for self-action and self-guidance. I think this would be the principal value or the symbolism of the carnelian. The month of September has as its particular symbol the chrysolite. There seemed to be very little division of thinking on that particular subject. This is a symbol or a structure involved in reward. This is a sign of what comes to the good and faithful servant. Therefore, it draws to the individual, according to the old law, that which is his own, which he has earned. It is a certain pact between man and nature, that man will be provided for if he keeps the doctrine, if he keeps the law will keep him. Thus, it has to do with the natural enjoyment of that which has been earned and was in old times often given to persons retiring into the older age brackets as an indication that the future shall be a peaceful and wonderful reward for work well done. And for the younger person, it is a reminder that work well done will have its reward. It is tightly tied in to compensation and to the integrities of labor, by means of which we earn that which is good. It tells us to be ever mindful that there is an honesty in nature, and that this honesty will not be defiled, that it will bring to us according to our own achievements and our own understanding. The month of October was pretty nearly consistently bestowed to the beryl, a very nice and not especially rare stone, but one in which there is a great deal of interesting symbolism. The beryl is the symbol of the individual's ability to control the pressures of his own personality. October is a month of great pressure, and the beryl is a symbol, and was to the old peoples, a sign of contentment as being a simple acceptance of things as they are, the ability to sense and see good in the immediate, to say not how I wish for something, but how grateful I am for what has already come to me. Therefore, the beryl makes the individual mindful internally of the beauty, the truth, the love, and friendship he has enjoyed through the years. It is therefore a symbol of the good memory, of things that enrich us because we can draw them back to consciousness. It is the person who has the jewel of happiness in his own heart and mind. The beryl is therefore this heart-mind stone, that if we will read its mystery correctly, it will shine out always, telling us of the wonderful privileges and joys we have known, even though sometimes we become a little dissatisfied. The November stone is the topaz, and this stone is a suggestion of adjustment. The topaz comes in many colors, like the sapphire. It has a many-splendored glory, and in this diversity, the November individual is inspired to see or to understand the many phases of good, or the many phases of blessings, or the many divine privileges that we enjoy, and also how we can express outwardly in many ways. The topaz is the symbol of the radiance of the enlightened person, shining his light into many lives of different colors and kinds and adding new luster to all of them. Also, the topaz points out that each person lives many lives himself, and that the power of light brings color to all of them, so that in business and home, in art, music, literature, whatever he may be interested in, it is the light of his own understanding that makes all these things shine beautifully and gloriously. So the topaz reminds each person of the light in himself, and that the jewels of the world shine according to the light that he sheds upon them. He must make the jewels to shine, according to the old legends. And if he will add his own light, then the luster will be great and beautiful and permanent. December was given to the ruby, with all very little difference of opinion. And this would be natural because ruby is the symbol of blood. And each year the world hero dies at the winter solstice, the victim of the conspiracy of darkness. Therefore, blood becomes the symbol of the blood pact, of blood brotherhood. Blood in the ruby is the symbol that God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son into this world to die for men. This was the early Christian symbol of martyrdom, The ruby was the symbol of the glory of self-sacrifice. That the most wonderful privilege in all the world is to forget self in the service of that which is greater than self. Therefore, in each life, a self must die and its blood must be shed that an eternal self may be born therefrom. And as the phoenix rises from the ashes of its own dead, so the ruby is the symbol of the mysterious resurrection of life from death, the mysterious shedding of blood, which is a symbol of man giving his life for his friend. So the ruby was thus an emblem of self-sacrifice, of martyrdom, but also of a victorious release, a victorious achievement. The person who wears the ruby was supposed, therefore, to be one who has risen out of his own past, transcended his own sorrows, and has dedicated himself completely and full-heartedly to the bringing of joy and peace and happiness to his world. The willingness to give of self, not what he has, but what he is. Therefore, in general, the stone is heroic unselfishness and the good that it can produce for all people in the world. Now, there is so much more that we could say, but our time is so much up, I guess we're just going to have to stop and let everybody somewhere along the line get a cup of coffee out in the patio, which I believe is being saved for this occasion. I think they figured that everyone would be exhausted and would need one by this time. Next Sunday morning, our subject is Health and the Zodiac, an introduction to astropsychology, and we hope that you'll be interested in it. I'd like to also say that we have a new manuscript lecture notes on the table on the re-education of public opinion, a lecture for which we had a great many requests. We also have a record that was used at the Christmas season and broadcast over a number of radio stations in which I read from our book, The Ways of the Lonely Ones, two stories, The Face of Christ and The Master of the Blue Cape. That is now available in recorded form. I'd like to also say that those of you who are interested in the Buddhist pictures that we advertised in some publicity material, which you may have received recently, due to the limitation of space in the lobby, we are unable to spread these out adequately. They can be seen in the library after the lecture, and can be also secured there if you are desirous of getting them. Incidentally, we have a new library exhibit this morning, which has to do with our own country and some of our religious and folk art and lore, so we hope that you will find it interesting. And don't forget, the coffee klatch will be waiting for you as you enthusiastically depart from here. Thank you very much.